So before we start this session, I wanted to let you know that this webinar series is also in support of an upcoming NIEHS NHLBI workshop, Understanding the Combined Effects of Environmental, Chemical, and Non-Chemical Stressors, Atherosclerosis as a Model. This workshop will take place at the NIEHS in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, and the dates are April 3rd and 4th, 2018. The goal of this workshop is to identify key biological mechanisms and pathways of the combined effects of chemical and non-chemical stressors associated with atherosclerosis. A critical research area that requires further exploration is the biological mechanisms and effects of exposure to both environmental chemicals and non-chemical stressors over time and the roles that they may play in the development of disease. This workshop will bring together experts to discuss the state of the science pertaining to underlying biological pathways associated with and when combined chemical and non-chemical stressors in relation to atherosclerosis. This workshop will use the AOP framework to assist in the discussion of the pathways considered by workshop participants. We welcome you to join us for the workshop, and please contact me if you have any questions or would like more information. So with that, we are ready to get started. So first we're going to hear from Dr. Carol Yauch. Dr. Yauch is the lead of the Genomics Laboratory in the Environmental Health Science and Research Bureau at Health Canada and an adjunct professor of biology at Carleton University. Dr. Yauch is co-chair of the Health Canada Genomics Working Group and a co-chair of the Application of Genomics to Mechanism-Based Risk Assessment Technical Committee of the Health and Environmental Sciences Institute. She is a Canadian delegate to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development's Extended Advisory Group on Molecular Screening and Toxicogenomics, and an active participant in their Adverse Outcome Pathway Program. Her current research is focused on the development and implementation of genomics approaches to improve and expedite risk assessment and novel approaches to assess potential heritable effects of environmental exposures. She has published over 140 papers in these areas. Dr. Yauch, I'd like now to turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for joining, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me to present about our AOP, which you can see written here, Alkylation of DNA Leading to Heritable Genetic Effects. And this AOP was used as a test case in developing the User's Handbook supplement. And so I actually refer the reader, the viewers, to this handbook supplement, which I believe is provided as supplementary material to this webinar, because it provides really detailed information about how to build an AOP. It's an excellent source of information with examples within it. Okay, so today I'm going to very briefly, just in about 5 minutes, give you the highlights of what AOPs are, for those of you who may have missed the last webinar. And then I will spend most of my time talking about our case study AOP. So I'll introduce some of the relevant background and our motivation for building the AOP. I'll tell you about how we went about selecting our key events and how we assessed the weight of evidence for the key event relationships and how we assessed the overall weight of evidence for the pathway. Above is an example AOP. This was given to me by Dan Villeneuve, who was one of your previous speakers, and the first slides that I'll be showing come from Dan or were derived from slides that Dan Villeneuve gave me. And you can see that it is bookended by a green and a red key events, which are the molecular initiating event and the adverse outcomes, respectively. And in between the yellow events are the intermediate key events. So the adverse outcome pathway is a conceptual framework that portrays existing knowledge concerning the linkages between direct molecular initiating events and adverse outcomes. Essentially, they're a way to organize information. They're based on biological plausibility and or statistical inference. And they provide a hypothesis and a set of measurements that we can actually use to test that hypothesis. The events span levels of biological organization that are relevant to risk assessment from the molecular level through to the population level if required. These are five main principles that I view as important in AOP development. The first is that AOPs are not chemical specific, and this is what differentiates them in part from mode of action. They rely on very similar principles, except the adverse outcome pathways begin with a molecular initiating event, and multiple stressors may perturb that molecular initiating event. AOPs are modular, and this is a really important principle because we can reuse these modules to build other AOPs. The AOPs are pragmatic simplifications of biology. They do not describe every aspect of biology or mechanism. And really critically to the efforts of this series is that it's really AOP networks that are the functional unit of prediction, which is also very different from mode of action. And this will be very important when considering combined effects of chemicals. Finally, AOPs are living documents. So they're constantly evolving. As an AOP is finalized, nothing is really ever completely closed on any issue. And as more research is emerging, these AOPs can be updated. There's two primary building blocks for AOPs. We have key events, which are the functional unit of observation. So these are observable changes in biological state. These are importantly measurable and also essential, but not necessarily sufficient. The other building block, of course, are the key event relationships, which helps us with our predictive toxicological modeling. These key event relationships are functional units of inference or extrapolation. They're directed relationships that describe how KE up leads to KE down, or how KE up, we can use KE up to infer KE down. They're supported by understanding of the biological plausibility and empirical evidence. And finally, in describing key event relationships, we have to consider the degree of quantitative understanding that we have of these key event relationships. This is probably the least well-developed part of the AOP program at this stage, but information should be coming out in the very near future to help explain in more detail how to assess the quantitative understanding of key event relationships. You can see that key event relationships are depicted here either with solid arrows or with dashed arrows. These solid arrows represent adjacent events, or what we refer to as direct relationships, whereas the dashed arrows leap over events, and these have been referred to as indirect relationships or as non-adjacent KERs. So in moving forward, these will be referred to as adjacent and non-adjacent key event relationships. I'm going to focus today primarily on the key event relationships because this is probably the most challenging aspect of AOP development. When you're developing an AOP in the AOP wiki, you'll be on a KER page. A KER page asks for the title of the KER, which is very simple to derive because it's the name of the KE and then leading to and the name of the next KE. And you describe that key event relationship. A typical mistake that people make, including myself, in describing key event relationships is to provide information about what's upstream or downstream of that key event relationship. It's important to always keep the modular nature of these AOPs in mind as you're developing things, with the understanding that others may reuse the key events and key event relationships. The next entries that you're required to consider are the biological plausibility of the key event relationship, which is based on normal biology and understanding of structural and functional relationships between key events. And then the biggest part is really diving into the literature and the data that you have to provide empirical support to demonstrate how KE up leads to KE down. So this is largely based on perturbation studies, for example, toxicological studies. Then, of course, you document inconsistencies and uncertainties and quantitative understanding of your key event relationship. Finally, at the end of having mapped out all your key events and your key event relationships, you're asked to conduct an overall weight of evidence assessment for your overall AOP. And the Bradford Hill criteria, the modified Bradford Hill criteria, are used for this. And there's excellent information in the user's handbook to help guide you on how to assign weight of evidence to your overall AOP. The first consideration is biological plausibility, i.e., is there a mechanistic relationship between the upstream KEs and the downstream KEs. That's consistent with established biological knowledge. And the user's handbook and within the wiki, there are guidelines to help you determine if you have high, moderate, or low confidence. Next, you'd consider the essentiality of the key events within your pathway. So are the KEs that are downstream of your event blocked? When you block a particular KE, is the adverse outcome prevented, for example? And so, again, there's instructions on how you might consider the weight of evidence to be high, moderate, or low. And then finally, you're again considering the empirical support for all of the key event relationships that you've already defined. As I mentioned, and very critically for your exercise, for your purposes, for most real-world applications, an AOP network is the functional unit of prediction. So in this case, we have the, let me see if my cursor's working here, there we go. We have the original AOP that I demonstrated on the first slide shown here. But you can see how Dan Villeneuve, in this case, has leveraged this parental AOP and brought in other molecular initiating events and key events that come in at later stages, later key events in his parent AOP. And so we can see how all of these molecular initiating events together contribute to the adverse outcome. And importantly, of course, there may be other adverse outcomes that result from any particular one of these MIEs. So when it comes to developing your AOP, these are our recommendations. The first is to create a flow diagram similar to the one here in the middle of the screen of Dan's original AOP. And so map this out. And then the next step is really to search through the existing content on the in the AOP knowledge base to look for related AOPs, key events, and key event relationships. And once you've identified that existing content, you figure out if your AOP can link to it. And then you're ready to really begin your AOP development. So you would, we would go into, for example, the AOP wiki, and you would build your AOP by linking to existing content and creating new pages as needed. So let's get to the case study then on alkylation of DNA leading to heritable genetic effects. And the principle behind this is that if there's genetic damage that's occurring in sperm or egg, this genetic damage can lead to mutations that are transmitted to an offspring. And this is important in our opinion because germline mutations are deleterious and they can result in the death of the developing embryo. And equally important, of course, is that this can result in genetic disease and can contribute to the population gene pool. So our motivation for this AOP was to begin with something that we know a lot about. And this was one of the first AOPs that was actually reviewed under the OECD's AOP program. In genetic toxicology, alkylating agents are very well studied. They're one of the first chemical stressors ever identified as mutagens. So we felt it was a good place to start. Also, there were some new methods that we were interested in, and AOPs provide a context of use for new methods and technologies. And our AOP builds in both somatic and germ cell mutation effects, so we felt this was a great tool for us to provide context for these methods. We also wanted to emphasize that there, despite the fact that research in this area has been going on for decades, there are still gaps in research in this field. And anybody who is developing an AOP will quickly realize how effective the AOP framework is in helping to identify research gaps. Most importantly, de novo mutations, heritable mutations, are increasingly recognized as contributing to a large array of human genetic diseases. And we have, as a result, been proposing and pushing changes in the way assessment of heritable genetic effects are considered in risk assessment. All right, now a little bit of background to help you to understand the AOP. Alkylating agents add alkyl groups to cellular molecules, and of interest to this AOP is alkylation of DNA. This is extremely well studied and understood. On the left-hand side, you can see a diagram of where alkyl adducts are formed on nucleotides and on the phosphate backbone. This is from Ney and O'Connor in 2013. It's important to note that each of these different alkyl adducts would have different degrees of stability. Now, AOPs are not chemical specific, but they often borrow heavily from prototype agents because quite reasonably, much of the data in one area may be biased towards work on one agent in particular. In this case, the majority of data is based in our AOP is based on the chemical N-ethyl-N-nitrosourea, a very well-established prototype alkylating agent. Although information in somatic cells came from a lot of different sources of alkylating agents, for our germ cell work, it was primarily on ENU is the name of the, is the acronym for the chemical. An important concept to bear in mind is that alkylatics can be repaired. So this is something that has to be overcome before there will be mutations manifested from exposure to an alkylating agent. The primary repair protein is alkylguanine transferase, or methylguanine methyltransferase, AGT, or MGMT. So these enzymes irreversibly bind the alkyl groups, and so they're inactivated. They're suicide enzymes. They're dead after they've accepted an alkyl molecule. So this means that they're very efficient at repairing alkylation of DNA at low doses, but these enzymes become overwhelmed at high doses, and alkylatics are therefore retained. And also, these enzymes are not necessarily good at repairing all types of adducts. In addition to creating an adduct, the next critical step is replication of DNA. The adduct itself does not cause the mutation. It's replication of the adducted DNA that causes the mutation. So the mutations at this point during replication become fixed and propagate to daughter cells. And we understand this very well. For example, O4 thymine alkylation leads to AT to GC transitions, and O6 guanine alkylations lead to GC to AT transitions. At the bottom, I've noted that some adducts are not mutagenic, so we have to do more than just measure adducts. For example, N-alkyl adducts tend to be bypassed error-free. Our target cells for the overall AOP are spermatogonial stem cells. Mutations in these stem cells can persist and clonally expand, and therefore we feel that this is these are the most critical target cells. Sperm derived from these stem cells will carry mutations, and then fertilization of an egg with sperm carrying these mutations can result in an offspring carrying mutations. So then it comes time to actually build the AOP. The first thing to do is to select the endpoints in our AOP that we can measure. So this schematic shows check marks next to endpoints in our AOP that we can measure, and X's next to things that we either cannot or do not measure. So first, we can readily measure DNA adducts, so I have a check mark. These adducts, as I mentioned, are either repaired or not repaired, and there's different ways to measure that. The adducts need to the DNA needs to be replicated in order for mutation to occur, but we don't measure that. We ensure that replication has happened in our assays, but we don't measure that replication has occurred. Mutations manifest, and we can measure mutations in both somatic cells and sperm. If these mutations occur in sperm, they need to fertilize an egg, and we do not measure this. We mate the animals, but we do not actually measure that fertilization has occurred. Instead, we measure whether the offspring has mutations. And one of the motivations for developing this AOP is that it's extremely difficult to measure offspring with mutations because these mutations are rare events. And so one of the motivations was to see how our early events are able to predict the number of offspring that would have mutations. So here's our AOP, beginning with mapping out the molecular initiating event here on the left, alkylation of DNA, leading through insufficient or incorrect repair to mutations, and finally to inherited mutations. Note that the final key event relationship, or KER, occurs in male premeiotic germ cells. And so that means that although we can use a lot of evidence in the early key events from somatic cells, that this AOP is only as broad overall as effects on male premeiotic germ cells. We have both direct relationships or adjacent relationships and indirect relationships. And the reason we inserted these non-adjacent relationships is because there aren't a lot of studies measuring insufficient or incorrect repair. And so when it came to assessing the empirical evidence, it was a lot easier to find studies that had measured alkylation of DNA or alkyl adducts and mutations or alkyl adducts and inherited mutations. And so this allows us to strengthen the overall weight of evidence from the AOP because we don't have to look only at the adjacent events. So then we enter the information into the AOP knowledge base, and this is the AOP wiki page for our AOP. And here is a summary of the key events and the key event relationships. At the top, you can see the key events. If you click on these hyperlinks, it brings you to descriptions of the key events and how you measure them and in what species. You'll see the table of KERs. And again, if you click on these links, it will take you to the summary of all the information that we put together to assess and present that one key event leads to the next. And then finally, after you've created your key event relationships, the AOP wiki itself generates a network view that you see at the bottom here. And this network view shows my molecular initiating event in blue and my adverse outcome in yellow and my two key events in green. It shows the adjacent relationships with the solid bar and the dashed or the non-adjacent, and it shows that my AOP is linked to two other AOPs within the AOP wiki. So let's talk about the weight of evidence for the key event relationships. I've already described in great detail the biological plausibility and that the events and the key event relationships are pretty well understood and highly biologically plausible. So I'm going to jump into the empirical evidence in support of the relationships. And so here we're trying to find evidence to support that KE1 occurs, for example, before KE2, and that the incidence of KE1 is greater than KE2. And we really want to examine in detail the concordance of the dose and the response-response relationship. So one of the mistakes that people make in developing AOPs is describing an individual key event and its dose-response relationship, rather than putting that in the context of the downstream key event that they're trying to confirm a linkage to. In this example, I'm going to focus on these indirect key event relationships. So ideally, what you want to do is find studies that measured more than one of your key events in a single paper. This isn't always possible, though, and in our case, it was possible only for a few things. In general, what we had to do was to look across papers. So here's an example of how we did that. On the left is a paper from Saylor et al. In 1997 in hamsters showing that when you expose the hamsters to ENU or another alkylating agent, DEN, you see an increase in DNA adducts. So this is adducts on the Y and time after injection on the X. And you can see that the adducts form early on. DEN requires metabolism, so it takes a little bit of time to reach the peak, but for ENU, a direct-acting agent, alkyl adducts are highest immediately after the exposure, and then they decline back to baseline levels after a few days. In contrast, when we look in sperm of rodents, we don't see mutations occurring immediately. We see them occurring much later in time, and in this example that I'm showing over here on the right, in a paper from Jason O'Brien in 2015, you can see that these animals, which are mutamice, were exposed for 28 days to ENU. And at this first time point, we measured, after that 28-day exposure, we waited 3 days to see if we could see mutations in sperm. And there was not much of anything going on here. But after we've waited 70 days, we can see a significant increase in the number of mutations in sperm arising. So the adducts occur early and the mutations are coming later. This was a fantastic plot that I found in a paper from Jim Swenberg et al. In 2008 in human cells and culture. And in this plot, what you see are alkyl adducts on this axis plotted with the diamonds, the solid diamonds here, and you can see these increasing with dose of this alkylating agent MMS. But the open circles here are the mutations that are occurring. And you can see very clearly that we have to pass this threshold where the enzyme is overwhelmed before we begin to see mutations, and that the incidence of adducts is higher than the incidence of mutations. In terms of looking at this evidence in germ cells overall, this is a table comprising all of the literature that I could find across studies on alkyl adducts and mutations in sperm and mutations in offspring. So this is across about 8 different studies. You can see the studies used different doses, I made sure in this case that they were all from the same route of exposure. You can see the incidence per 10 to the 7 nucleotides of alkyl adducts here are higher, and this is 2 hours post-exposure in rodent male germ cells, are higher than the number of mutations per 10 to the 7 cells. So one of the things that I had to do in this example was convert everything to a per nucleotide metric. You can see that the adduct levels are higher than the mutations, and that the mutations in sperm are quite similar to mutations in the offspring. So in this case, we have to wait that extra step because they've exposed, and the animals are then mated, and then we're looking at the offspring. So this is obviously happening well after the adducts have occurred. But the best way to really look at this is in a diagram, a plot. And so here we have incidence per 10 to the 7 nucleotides, and in blue you can see that these are the alkyl adducts, and there's many more alkyl adducts than there are mutations, shown with the red bars and the green triangles. And we had to consider our uncertainties and inconsistencies. There were data gaps. The most important one for us for the germ cell aspect was that the empirical evidence came almost entirely from the chemical ENU. There was limited evidence for four or five other alkylating agents, but this evidence was not extensive. There were some inconsistencies across experiments due to substandard protocols. There were some inconsistencies in incidence concordance, and here I would indicate that it's not always appropriate to quantitatively compare some endpoints. In our case, comparing mutations in the mutamouse, which is a LAC-Z reporter gene, to mutations in 7 endogenous genes using the Russell 7 locus test is probably not the fairest of comparisons. It was also a bit challenging at times to compare experiments because there were differences in the design. Now we'll go to the overall weight of evidence for the entire AOP rather than focusing on the individual key event relationships. The overall AOP is based on 32 high-quality studies across rodents, flies, and fish. There was no single strong study that compared multiple events, but we could easily make extrapolations across studies by expressing the units per nucleotide for the different studies. As I've described, there's broad understanding and extensive knowledge of the biological plausibility of all of the key event relationships, and it's generally a very widely accepted. ENU is a prototypical germ cell mutagen, so in terms of assigning a weight of evidence to this, we would say strong. Essentiality is something we haven't touched on yet. So essentiality in this case could only be considered for one key event, and that's the insufficient repair key event. For example, we can't remove mutations from sperm and then mate the organism to see if they produce offspring with sperm. But we can modulate DNA repair. And in the example that I'm showing at the bottom here, from Alle et al. 1999, we have, again, a rodent transgene reporter assay being used to measure LACI mutant frequency, in this case in thymus and liver, in both wild type and AGT overexpressing animals treated with the chemical ENU. And you can see a major increase in mutation frequency in thymus and liver in the wild type, and that this is largely suppressed by AGT overexpression. And so there's great evidence from a variety of different studies showing that overcoming DNA repair is required, because knockdown of DNA repair, following alkylation agent exposure, we see increases in mutation, and overexpression of DNA repair decreases the mutations. So we call the overall essentiality call for this AOP as moderate, since it's only based on one key event, but it's excellent evidence. And then we consider the empirical support. So this is looking across all the key events in the pathway and asking, is there evidence that a change in KE up leads to an appropriate change in KE down? So for example, and specifically, does KE up occur at lower doses in earlier time points than KE down? And is the incidence of KE up greater than that of KE down? In our case, in this AOP, it's strong primarily for the indirect or non-adjacent KERs. However, we emphasize that KE measurements were based on either OECD test guideline or what's considered gold standard approaches. So we have high confidence in the measures that we used for our assessment. So overall, we ranked this as moderate to strong. So just to wrap up then, to let you know, we are currently leveraging the key events and the key event relationships within this AOP to build other AOPs. You can find the AOP in the AOP Wiki. It's AOP number 15. It's undergone the external and internal review process for AOP development, and I would be happy to take questions about this. There's not a lot of time to talk about it, but this is obviously very critical to how these AOPs are, how they're useful or not to regulatory assessment, the degree of review and scrutiny that they've been subject to. You can also see our paper that describes how we use this AOP as a test case that's published. But one thing I wanted to point out is some people have been reluctant in the past to make AOPs because there's a significant amount of work and they don't necessarily lead to a publication. But the OECD has now introduced their OECD series on adverse outcome pathways, shown right here, OECD series on adverse outcome pathways. So once your AOP has gone through the internal and external review process and is endorsed by the OECD, it's published in this OECD series, so it becomes an official publication that you can find in PubMed. And I will stop there, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or have a discussion about the review process or to listen to your comments.
Well, thank you, Carol, so much for your excellent presentation, which I think is a great background information and then a description of your specific AOP. So now we are going to take questions from the Q&A pod, and I wanted to remind the audience participants that you may submit your questions using the Q&A pod you see in the lower right-hand corner. So the first question that came in was it difficult? Well, it's actually two questions. Was it difficult to get your AOP started, and do you have a team working with you on this AOP, or is this something that you could do on your own?
Well, those are great questions. So we were sort of guinea pigs in this program. We started pretty much immediately as soon as the AOP program was formed. We started to think about how we could develop AOPs in the area of germ cell mutagenesis. So the way I started was actually getting together a group of people in the form of a half-day workshop to talk about what AOPs in our area we thought were important and worth developing and which ones we would have enough evidence to build. And so that was back in 2013 when I did that. And from that, we came up with a number of different AOPs, and this was the first one identified as a priority. So I did this pretty much the first draft entirely on my own, and then I solicited input from all the experts that I had engaged previously and from Betty Meek and Dan Villeneuve, who are part of the EGMIST program, the Extended Advisory Group on Molecular Screening and Toxicogenomics. But our experience from there has been one of my former PhD students, Francina Webster, has developed an AOP on her own. And so it is something that you can do on your own or as part of a group. I recommend collaborating as much as possible. People tend to be experts on individual key event relationships rather than entire AOPs, and it's really helpful to get others involved in the process.
Okay, great. Thank you. So the next question, again, it's kind of a two-part question. Can you or should you give others permission to modify your KERs or other elements of your AOPs? And what do you do if there's disagreement among researchers of the best KERs or AOPs to study?
I think that's a great question, too. So, yes, you can modify the KEs and the KERs, and that's why we call them living documents. And the polite thing to do, well, first of all, you have to get developer rights in order to be able to modify anything. In order to do that, you have to apply through the AOP, the society, or through the OECD. And there's information on the AOP Wiki for how to do that. Everybody is free to comment, but only people who have registered and have a login can modify. So the polite thing to do is to contact the authors and work with them, the authors of the key event or the KER that you want to use, to work with them to modify the key event. And this is a really important question right now, because a lot of people, you know, in the initial enthusiasm here, started a lot of AOPs and didn't get very far in their descriptions of their key events or their key event relationships and left things kind of incomplete. And so those AOPs are free to be developed, but it would be important to contact the authors and work with them to get consensus on how to modify those. When an AOP has undergone the full external review process, then I think you have to think a little bit more about how much things should be modified. But all of the AOP authors are experts in the area, and you can work with them to determine, you know, how best to modify them. Now, in terms of when there's a discrepancy or a disagreement, these AOPs that are published have been extensively reviewed by subject matter experts. So it might be something that you'd have to take up with the lead authors as well as the EGMIST committee for really significant modifications to something.
Okay, well, thank you. So the next one that came in is, what would you say is the critical impact of having formalized so successfully an AOP for heritable mutations from alkylating agents, a hypothesis that has been around and I think well supported for years?
The original idea, of course, was to just learn how to build an AOP and to have a case study that could really show us how we can use old empirical data and new empirical data to build the AOP. So we really wanted this as a case study. The advantage of having this now is that we have new assays that we can use. So measuring heritable mutations in an offspring is extremely difficult and almost never ever done. The Russell 7 locus test was the gold standard, and it used tens, if not hundreds of thousands of animals in a single test. So we were trying to build the case that we should just be able to measure mutations in offspring and to look to see how correlated, mutations in sperm, and that we should be able to predict the probability that this mutation would be manifest in the offspring from that. Also, we want to be able to see how much our somatic cell work supports that effects may also be occurring in germ cells. And there's new test methods being developed that we can plug into this AOP that help in predictive toxicology. So I hope that answers the question. It's a very good question. I mean, initially it was to provide a prototype, but most importantly, it's to also build on these new tests that we can use to predict endpoints that are difficult, if not impossible, to measure using today's standards.
Okay, thank you for that. So I think we have time for probably one more question. How do you handle temporal influences within your pathway, and what if key events occur simultaneously?
Simultaneous is concordant. So if key events are occurring at the same time, that is a concordant relationship, so that's fine. In terms of temporal concordance, it's sometimes difficult to find good studies that have done a time series analysis. In our case, we were very fortunate for adducts that and for mutations that time series have been done. But you'd often have to look across studies in order to get that temporal relationship really nailed down. So I'm not sure if that really answers the question, but at least I can confirm to you that when two things are happening at the same time, that is still a concordant association in terms of timing.
Okay, well, great. So I think that we're going to hold off on other questions for now, but again, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Yauch, for your presentation, and I'm sure that we'll have time to ask you more questions at the end of the webinar. So now we're going to hear from Dr. Justin Teagarden, our next speaker. And Dr. Teagarden is a staff scientist and chief exposure scientist in the Environmental and Biological Sciences Directorate at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. He holds a joint faculty position with the Oregon State University Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology, where he serves as the director for the OSU PNNL Superfund Research Center Research Translation Corps. He also directs the Texas A&M Superfund Exposure Science Corps. Dr. Teagarden's research focuses on computational and experimental exposure assessment in humans, animals, and cell culture systems. Over the last decade, his research teams have focused on utilization of emerging technologies, novel experimental data, and computational methods for solving public health challenges related to human exposure to chemicals. He is currently the director of the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory Exposure Surveillance and Health Optimization Consortium and the chief exposure scientist, where he leads efforts to develop non-targeted analytical methods for characterizing the exposome. So, Justin, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Danielle, thanks for the introduction, and I would just say, Sarah, I really hoped you guys wouldn't read that whole thing. I really appreciate it, but it's like a presentation in and of itself, so my apologies to everybody for that, and greetings to everybody out there. So after a series of, I think, really great talks on the mechanistic aspects of toxicology, sort of in the form of AOPs, my charge is to kind of to demonstrate the critical importance of exposure and exposure science as we think about constructing sort of a more complete framework that kind of promotes what is largely the intersection between what I think is largely two very separate fields of inquiry, that that's focused on chemical stressors and its involvement in environmental health, and that that's focused on non-chemical stressors and involvement in say, public health. So very much the environmental health research side of things and the biomedical research enterprise, if you will. And we're looking to kind of think about ways that we can promote the intersection between those two fields. So in order to sort of get us started here thinking along those lines, I want to start by contrasting these two research paradigms. And this is kind of a brief summary that I put together, very simple. But I would say that the biomedical research paradigm that's largely funded through NIH and other government agencies really starts with the disease, whether that is identified through surveillance or other means. There's a tremendous amount of effort that's focused, I'm looking for the pointer here, on mechanistic research, okay? Lots of research that's done here, and often then building on that mechanistic understanding starts to look at issues and questions surrounding human susceptibility and what the drivers of susceptibility are. And eventually, as that the research moves along, we hopefully find a druggable target and start looking for candidate therapeutics. But at the end of this paradigm, there actually is a very important exposure science question that gets asked. It's in many ways one of the most important questions, and that is, if we have a druggable target, can we actually design a drug that gets us to sufficient exposure at, for example, the molecular initiating event for that biological effect to actually give us an effective therapy? So this is, by nature, asking whether or not we can create a viable drug, and the question is an exposure science question. And I would argue to this audience, at least for today's sake, that the research on the left here is in general of lower impact than research that's done on the right side here, where we're really getting to the questions about whether or not the exposure gives us a drug and gives us the candidate therapy. If I was writing a grant, my preference would be to writing an impact and significance section that was in this particular area here rather than in these earlier areas. So thinking in contrast about what I would call the parallel paradigm for toxicology and environmental health research, again, we start with a disease or a hazard that may have been identified through some screening program, of which there's many right now. Tremendous amount of research here just in hazard identification. Here in hazard identification. Again, we move on to mechanism. A tremendous amount of work here done in mechanistic studies and toxicology. And then, of course, moving on to genetic understanding of susceptibility in populations. But, of course, we don't work in this paradigm really on candidate therapeutics. This might be more a box that comes later when we think about exposure mitigation strategies. But in the end, this key question toward the end, is there sufficient exposure for the health effects to drive the hazard in the disease, is not something that's funded at a high level or gets a lot of attention and focus, not at the same extent that we do in the biomedical research program paradigm. So that leaves us with the problem in that we're really not sure whether for the hazards and such, the mechanisms that are studied very deeply, whether or not there's a true risk associated with that particular exposure. So there's some interesting outcomes from this, and this is an observation I think many of you probably have made yourself, especially if you're doing risk assessment work, for example. Toxicologists might do their studies in vivo and in vitro systems and identify some effects in those systems, changes in insulin regulation, neurological effects, or estrogenic effects in an in vitro model. Epidemiologists might pick up on this or the effects of that particular chemical, or maybe have observed it themselves in their association studies. And they see endpoints in humans that might clearly relate to things that have been identified, similar endpoints or related effects in the test systems. And then the two communities in the publications begin referring to the other. So the toxicologists refer to the epidemiology as supporting evidence and vice versa. So there's this mutually reinforcing, evolving data sets that emerge, and it implies very high impact. But the question is whether or not exposure science is really being used properly as a bridge between those two fundamental exploratory kinds of studies. And ultimately, what we often find is that the test concentrations in the tox studies, which are really designed for hazard and mechanism, are much higher than those that are observed in humans or are plausible in humans, which leads to a key question. So thinking again about those two paradigms, in the one case, we're looking for high enough exposure for effective drugs, but on the mitigation side for environmental exposures, the question is, are these diseases then addressable with exposure intervention? So if the exposures are low here, but high in the tox side of things, then I think it implies that exposure intervention is really not going to help us solve what we perceive to be an environmental health problem. So just a few quick points here. I want to make this last point, these last two most of all. A key part of this is whether or not on the tox side, when we're constructing mechanistic arguments or identifying hazards, whether or not we're dividing AOPs, whether or not the biology is very different at the doses that we're using, the exposures we're testing, than in the humans where the exposures can, don't have to be, lower than they are in the test systems. And the second layer of this below here is how do we relate the exposures across test systems? Again, in most publications, the comparison between two studies is really just made at the level of, I saw the effect in cells, I saw the effect in animals, and there's been reported effects in humans. And part of the trouble is that it's difficult to make the associations in exposure across those systems, but I think it's an absolutely critical thing that we do. So for example, here's the way it might look. Researchers are working in a rodent system, on the left here, or an in vitro model. And the first question is, how do the biological responses compare to what we're really interested in typically here is in a human or in an ecological component of an ecosystem? First question is whether or not there's enough fidelity in these systems biologically so that you would actually expect to be able to see the effects that you see in the ecosystem element. And the second fundamental question is whether or not the exposures compare. I've already described why that's important, but you can again see that it's not either natural nor is it easy to make comparisons about these exposures. But fundamentally, if the exposures in one system are wildly lower or higher than the exposures in the other system, it seems unlikely that the biology that you're reporting on is really related to one another. So it becomes a problem of concordance, for example, and that's something that AOP developers certainly have to address. So this is a problem that's somewhat confounded by all the innovation, really great innovation, in the development of various test systems. So it's no longer that we just work in whole animals or that we work in cell culture systems, but we're innovating and developing a lot of new systems, cell-free systems, organs on a chip, air-liquid interface systems, particularly important for thinking about particle exposures, where liquid systems are much more challenging to use. But what's important is that each of these systems that we're working with have very different processes that influence the exposure to the tissues in those models. So for example, even in cell-free systems, you can have protein binding issues that remove the active compound. You can have binding of the active compound at the sides of plasticware, et cetera, that are used in those assays, as you can in cell culture and these others. And on top of that, in these other systems, you have issues like metabolism and partitioning, particle density and solubility when it comes to testing nanoparticles. And these are processes we really need to know if we're to try to figure out how to understand those systems well enough that we can define consistent metrics of exposure that allow us to align the responses across these systems through aligned exposures. Without doing this, this challenge of understanding how the biology that we're reporting actually informs us about either risks or the exposures and the likelihood of causing effects is very limited. So this is a pretty important challenge. And so I want to show you what I think is the impact of the absence of that kind of thinking or those capabilities in this large research community focused on understanding hazards and mechanisms. So this is essentially an assemblage, if you will, of dose and exposure data for bisphenol A, a very well-known, one of the most highly studied compounds, I think. And on the left here on the panel, we have study concentration for the in vitro studies in nanomolar. The x-axis is the study number, so each one of these little lines is a study, and each dot is a dose in that study. That's why there's vertical lines of dots, each representing a dose. And this is the same sort of plot on the right side, but it's external concentration, so just more crude measures of exposure, micrograms per kilogram per day. So because we have tremendous information on the pharmacokinetics of bisphenol A from multiple human studies that were designed as PK studies and design studies in non-human primates, we have a lot of information on the level of exposure in humans because bisphenol A is eliminated 100% in urine, which means urine biomonitoring is informative about total exposure. We can put those two things together and make great, very high accuracy estimates of human blood concentrations. And they've also been measured as well. So we're confident that this is the range of human blood concentrations down here that we can compare to test concentrations. And the upshot of this analysis is that these studies that were all self-identified by the authors as human relevant, environmental relevant, or low dose are in fact not so. They cross about six orders of magnitude, and the preponderance of them were conducted at exposures multiple orders of magnitude higher than human blood concentrations or tissue concentrations. If we just look on the external exposure side, the same conclusion can be made. Okay, so this is a case where years and years of research was probably not focused in the right exposure domain, which then means that we have to ask questions about its relevancy to human hazards. This has also been true in the nanotoxicology field, which I've done a little bit of work in over the years, and I think it can be characterized the early years as heroic particle exposures in vitro. And we have some of the same challenges because we're working with particles in submerged exposure systems, like cell culture systems, air-liquid interface, where it becomes very challenging for people to understand without direct measurement how a micromolar or a nanomolar of particles actually relates to a number of particles or a mass of particles reaching the cells at the bottom. And this little image here of these two containers with carbon nanotubes in them makes this point well. So these are carbon nanotubes on the left and on the right. The one on the right has a different surfactant placed on it. And you can see that after time, this carbon nanotube, which is a large fiber, settles out in this container, whereas these on the left stay suspended. And the authors reported that the ones on the right were more toxic than the ones on the left. And I think most of you looking at this might say, well, that could be either because they're intrinsically more toxic or because a much larger proportion of a dosed mass in that in vitro system simply settled out and ended up being the cells were exposed to a much higher dose. So these are the kinds of things that are important in these test systems. And then, of course, understanding how these doses, these particle systems, might reflect human exposures for inhaled particles, okay? So very similar in the nanoparticle world. So now, changing gears just quickly to make another important point for this group, I want to contrast what I'll call the penetrance of mechanistic thinking and exposure science frameworks in environmental health training and research, okay? So this is my opinion. I think, first of all, starting just with the title, I think most of us would probably acknowledge that there's a widely accepted opinion that biological networks produce toxicological outcomes, or disease if you want to think about it that way. And that mechanistic thinking overall, I would argue, have really impacted almost every aspect of toxicology. Okay, so we can think of that in terms of mechanism of action, mode of action, or AOP, but these are all representations of some general overarching organizational framework for the field of toxicology that influences every aspect of the field. It doesn't matter whether you are developing QSAR models or you're doing risk assessment or investigative toxicology at a pharmaceutical company or designing high-throughput studies based, for example, on AOPs that have been developed. This mechanistic thinking is always a part of what toxicologists do, and it's a fundamental part of their training. In contrast, I would argue that exposure networks, some people recognize, also produce exposure outcomes, much like these mechanisms produce toxicological outcomes, okay? But it's much less completely embraced by the broad environmental or exposure science community. It is by those that work on fate and transport models. This is fundamental to the way they think about problems in exposure science, and those that often work on conceptual site models and cleanup sites. But it isn't true that I believe that people who work in environmental monitoring or human biomonitoring, for example, typically think about exposure as being part of a large network that delivers exposures to, for example, a site of action to trigger a molecular initiating event in an AOP. It's simply not how the field really thinks about things. And so that led a group of us from Oregon State University's Superfund program and some of my colleagues at the US EPA, Cecilia Tan and Steve Edwards, to essentially write a paper, what we call sort of a sister paradigm or concept to the AOP concept or framework called the aggregate exposure pathway. And I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but really the point of what we were trying to do was maybe twofold, and that was to remind the broader community in exposure science that there are these pathways exist, and that when one is working in any aspect of exposure science, they should be thinking about this network and about how to design studies and collect data in a way that really optimizes its use for organizing that data and for its application to whatever the need is, either identifying sources and mitigating sources of exposure on the one side, or in delivering specific exposure data to people working in risk assessment with mechanisms of action and AOPs that allow them to then make risk-based decisions on those data. And I don't want to spend too much on this time on this framework, and so I'll just say a few things. We designed the framework in its most structured way, although our view is this is supposed to be very flexible. That is, unlike the AOP, you don't have to work across all these boxes. If you want to work just on pharmacokinetics in humans or animals, that's perfectly fine. You're working with part of an aggregate exposure pathway. Nonetheless, this was designed to look a lot like AOPs and borrow from its language, if you will. So here we have on the left one AEP, aggregate exposure pathway for a chemical. And all we're trying to show here is that these describe the movement of the compound from source through various exposure media, perhaps environmental media, air, water, soil, et cetera, to reach an external exposure in humans or a test animal, if that's what you're working in, and eventually then to create a target site exposure, and finally to intersect at the molecular initiating event to drive an AOP or a mechanism of action. And you can also have an AEP for a second compound. It's a different compound now. But that compound actually goes through some environmental transformation or metabolism in vivo that produces a metabolite that's equal to this first compound. So these AEPs can actually intersect, if you will, to drive exposure to an AOP. Similarly, we can aggregate exposure pathways themselves for multiple compounds. For example, if we're interested in all ligands that bind the estrogen receptor, because we're interested not in the estrogenicity of one compound, but all compounds that we're exposed to, then you can aggregate these AOPs across estrogenic compounds. And then you can use those exposure networks to create the information you need to identify the exposure concentrations at the site of action that drives a particular AOP. Okay, so this is, again, the very structured and formalized approach that we sort of described for the AEP, but it doesn't have to be that structured in its use. So I want to give you an example of what happens when you actually do this. And again, this is with bisphenol A. So if we link up the AEP and the AOP for this particular compound, and we think about the molecular initiating event being binding to one of the various estrogen receptors, type 2 receptors, ER-alpha, ER-beta, or GPR30, which is a membrane-bound non-classical estrogen receptor, or the most high affinity receptor, the ER-gamma. And we asked the question using a little bit of mathematics, given the concentrations that we see in people's blood, that's these dots back here, or we simulate these lines here for women of childbearing age and children or infants. If we ask the question, what fraction of the estrogen receptor could or should be bound under those exposure conditions, what we find is that even under the most high affinity receptor, ER gamma, we're talking about exceptionally low levels of receptor binding. For example, during pregnancy, you end up with much higher levels, say 50 to 80, 90% of estrogen receptors bound comparatively from normal levels of estradiol, estrone, and estriol in the body. So this is very low compared to what we'd expect to be biologically active levels of estradiol or estrogenic compounds. So it becomes important then, you get a very different conclusion about the importance of the mechanistic work that's been done and the hazards that have been identified when you actually link those to the AEP and the AOP. So now I want to try to move quickly into some simple conceptual ideas about how you link chemical and non-chemical stressors, thinking a little bit about the workshop that's going to be planned for the spring. And the linkage really is through mechanisms. So first, a couple of basic principles to think about. So we've been talking mostly up until this point about this part, that mechanisms really describe, or AOPs really describe, how stressors, mostly chemical stressors at this point, cause disease. Okay, and there's different ways that we can refer to those mechanisms, different ways that we can describe them. Second principle, that molecules largely are the transducers of chemical and non-chemical stresses that cause disease or adverse outcomes. So the point here is, even if you have a non-chemical stressor, at some point, that is going to be, the effect is transduced in the body through another molecule that becomes the measurable event. And here are some basic, if you will, AOPs or mechanisms that describe some critical outcomes. So this is the one that Carol showed you, showing that you can have chemical stress in fish that influences estradiol levels in the blood and eventually ends up reducing spawning behavior, for example, or ovulation, and then reduces the population. But you can also imagine, if you will, that some form of social stress in that population or other environmental stress, which is non-chemical, can also reduce spawning behavior. So there's a natural intersection between non-chemical stress here and chemical stresses. There's new hypotheses now about the relationship between environmental stressors and social and chemical stressors, if you will, and their effect on, for example, neurobehavioral outcomes. So environmental or social stresses can actually trigger a stress response that leads to release of cortisol. That stress response and cortisol itself can actually have effects on neurobehavioral outcomes. And there are certainly chemicals that we all know of, lead and some heavy metals and others, that can work within the brain to also, or the adrenal gland, so endocrine disruptors, for example, that they can obviously also cause influence this stress response and cause neurobehavioral outcomes. So again, good evidence that there's points of intersection. So there's good evidence that we've got these intersecting points between chemical and non-chemical stress. And also it should be clear that in most cases, multiple stressors and not both chemical and non-chemical stressors can converge through common mechanisms, key events, and molecular transducers to cause disease, right? That's sort of implied, I think, in the AOP framework, if you will. So thinking, these are just some good examples, and I don't want to spend too much time here, but this example on the right side here is fairly interesting. So again, there is some hypothesis now that psychological stress can actually, we've seen change, for example, cortisol levels and the levels of other hormones. Those hormone level changes actually can have an impact, direct impact on, for example, interleukin levels and lead to immune suppression. It turns out that these interleukins also are implicated as key signaling molecules that drive fatigue when they reach the brain. Similarly, as a point of intersection between chemical and non-chemical stress, chemicals can cause oxidative damage and nitrosative stress within the body. And it turns out that nitrosylated proteins are also implicated in driving fatigue signals in the brain. So again, there's a natural intersection between chemical and non-chemical stress, if you will, leading to multiple endpoints, either suppression of the immune system or fatigue. So There's an exposure science component of this, of course. I've kind of been through this. And again, the point is, even if there's these molecular intersecting events, we want to be very careful as we're thinking about these mechanisms that we know that the exposure levels are sufficient to drive those molecular transducers at the site of action to cause the initiation of the biology that leads to the adverse outcomes. Because the exposure level is going to have a strong influence not just on the mechanism itself, but on the severity and the probability of the outcome and the timing of the onset, which are all important considerations. So in this slide, I want to just point out that as this field of intersection between non-chemical and chemical stressors moves forward, we want to be very careful that we have complementary hypotheses that are explored in that particular research. And I would argue that the highest impact research from that emerging field is going to come when including testing of hypotheses regarding exposure is a part of that paradigm. So not just mechanisms, like is there a hypothesis that you hypothesize that a mechanistic basis exists for multiple stressors to contribute to the disease or outcome that you're studying, for example, arterial sclerosis. And similarly, that the level of non-chemical stress measured in humans and the level of chemical stress measured in humans is sufficient to induce the key events that are common to that AOP for that particular disease. It's important that all three of these hypotheses receive equal attention, I think, as the research moves forward. So a couple of conclusions here as I finish up. I think there's been a long preference in the field for funding the discovery of faster, richer, and deeper and more specific assays for biological response and for mechanistic research. And that I would argue that really needs to shift towards a greater balance between that particular type of work and exposure-related research for the reasons I mentioned before. I also think that the AEP and the AOP concepts, especially as they integrate, is a great conceptual framework for integrating chemical and non-chemical stressors. And my hope is this will push the field to evolve a little bit towards more coordinated, what I would call here mutually supported hypotheses regarding exposure and the rest of what we've talked about, mechanisms, biomarkers, and susceptibility and resistance. And furthermore, that I would hope the field moves toward assuring that even mechanistic studies and hazard studies are conducted at human-relevant exposures. So what do I think the overall impact of that's going to be? My hope is that that would stimulate new research programs that do a good job of working at the intersection of these fields that we talked about today and are equally grounded in both sides of the science that I think is necessary to assure high impact and significance. I think the reason NIH would push in this way in the first place is that they're hoping for a more comprehensive understanding of how environmental diseases evolve from a combination of both those stressors. And eventually, as I said, higher impact and higher significance research because the research is being done at what we find to be more relevant concentrations to human exposures. And that, with that, I'll just end with a large acknowledgement slide to the funding sources and my colleagues that have contributed to this thinking over the years. So thanks for your time.
Thank you, Justin. I think you did a great job in letting us know how to take exposure into consideration, which is incredibly important. It also helps to make sense of the biology and then giving us a view on perhaps how AOPs could be used in risk assessment. So, and I also really appreciate how you introduced the audience again to the non-chemical stressor workshop and atherosclerosis that's going to occur in April. So now we're going to take some questions from the Q&A pod for Justin. And so the first question that came in, and I think this is more a philosophical question for you, is should exposure in all studies be standardized in some way? So, for example, how humans, animals, and in vitro studies are conducted.
Yeah, so people tend to rebel against the notion of standardization, especially as it applies to the research environment. I think what I would say about that is I don't think we're ready to fully standardize exposure across these systems. And what I would argue for instead is that the people who are working with, for example, high throughput in vitro systems begin to do a better job of either directly measuring what those exposures are over the course of an in vitro system. So for example, measuring the nominal media concentrations over time to assure that, for example, the compound is not degrading rapidly over time so that you have a zero exposure or that it's sticking to the sides of the plate. So essentially to know better what those exposures are and in animal studies, at least to measure blood concentrations, so that we have some sort of common basis, for example, connecting nominal media concentrations to blood concentrations to biomonitored blood concentrations in humans. I think that's what I would push for rather than a full standardization, as just a movement toward meeting that basic goal.
Okay, thank you. The next question that came in is, can you go through slide number 14 again? In particular, the plots on the right-hand side are not clear. What do the colors mean, and what is the scale? So slide number 14.
Yeah, sorry, I kind of breezed through this. So let's see, the colors are not clear. So this is, on the left side, we have the serum BPA concentration, okay? And let's see, this is days of exposure so that we can lay out in these lines here. Where's my cursor? There it is. These lines here represent PBPK model simulations of women of childbearing age in the green and infants in the red. So those are simulated serum concentrations. You can also see that those concentrations sort of overlap the measured concentrations. The green was intended, the color scheme was intended just to indicate sort of the level of binding. So as the green gets darker, here you're reaching higher levels of receptor occupancy. As the red gets darker, higher levels. So you're approaching almost 100% receptor occupancy where the colors get dark. As they fade away, it's low receptor occupancy. It's better to look over here on the right side, where this is the fraction of the estrogen receptor that's bound at these levels of exposure. So I hope that clarifies things. And so these receptor occupancies were calculated using basic equilibrium conditions assumptions. So I hope that explains it. Maybe they can confirm via the Q&A.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
I would just point out that we've actually extended this work now into include all the hormones, all the endogenous estrogens, and the some dietary estrogens, the isoflavones, during pregnancy in women measured via biomonitoring. So we sort of carried this forward a little bit with some more experimental data.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I think we have time for one more question. So this one is, how do you develop an AEP when most exposure measures are, at least in human epidemiological studies, retrospective?
Retrospective. So again, one of the points that I would make here is that our intent was not to put people in the position of having to construct an entire AEP if their interest was in biomonitoring alone. So for example, if there was an interest in understanding how a particular compound moved from source to a human receptor for identifying sources and mitigating those exposures, then you might construct the entire AEP that I kind of described for you. If instead you're a person that's working on biomonitoring, what I would suggest, for example, is your interest would more be in understanding how, moving one step back, if you will, to how external exposures and external exposure measures relate to the internal measures that you may have made in blood, or, for example, the urine concentrations you're measuring, how all three of those things relate to each other quantitatively, because what we've found several times now is that can tell you a great deal about whether or not the external measures that you've made really are sufficient to drive the concentrations that are measured in urine or in blood. And so if you can get concordance because you understand external exposure and the pharmacokinetic elements of an AEP that drive blood concentrations and urine concentrations, if you can get that concordance, then you know you have high confidence in your exposure measure that you're using to correlate with an outcome. And then somebody in the future can actually, or somebody who's working in a different part of the field in the environmental monitoring side of things, can connect up their environmental monitoring side of things, the food, soil, water, et cetera, consumer products, and feed into your part of the AEP that describes from external exposure to internal exposure. So we're hoping that people will approach it that way, sort of modularly, rather than having to construct, feel like they have to construct the whole thing.
Okay, Okay, well, thank you, Justin. We will have to move on to the next presentation, but I do encourage the audience members to continue submitting their questions to Justin during our third presentation. So now we're going to move on to Dr. Ed Perkins. Dr. Perkins currently serves as a senior research scientist in the U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center. Dr. Perkins received his PhD at Washington State University investigating the molecular biology of 2,4-D degradation by, oh, I'm going to ruin that name, Alkagenus eutrophis, I hope JMP4. Prior to joining the Environmental Research and Development Center, Dr. Perkins worked in development of transgenic plants for phytoremediation and molecular measures of soil quality. Dr. Perkins joined the ERDC Environmental Laboratory in 1996, where he established an internationally recognized genetics research laboratory to examine chemical impacts on a wide range of species, including rat, bobwhite quail, Japanese quail, earthworms, fish, including fathead minnow and zebrafish, invertebrates such as Daphnia, and coral. His current work focuses on advancing methods in regulatory toxicology, such as the AOP framework, understanding the impact of chemical mixtures on the environment, the development and application of new tools and approaches for alternative methods in toxicology, and exploring how biotechnology can improve our environment. So, Dr. Perkins, thank you, and now I'm going to turn it over to you.
And just a quick reminder, Dr. Perkins, I'm going to help you come off of mute.
Oh, good. So can you hear me now?
We can. Thanks so much. Go ahead.
So I'd like to talk to you about how we're trying to use the AOP framework to understand chemical impacts. What we've been trying to do is how do we bridge biological networks, which is where we make a lot of measurements using omics data, and link this to AOPs, which is a wonderful framework for linking causal effects and molecular initiating events to outcomes of regulatory concerns. So, as you've heard over the series of talks and Carol reiterated, adverse outcome pathways are pragmatic and simple representations of essential events that lead to adverse outcomes of regulatory concerns. And what's nice about them is they're composed of discrete events that are measurable that represent in vitro or in vivo assays. So they're really built to try to take all these in vitro assays that we're trying to generate using TOX-21 sort of principles and try to use those and connect those to some outcome of regulatory concern. So it really helps in understanding how chemicals might cause toxicological effects of concern. So at its basic unit, AOPs are linear, but as you can see, and if you've seen some of the earlier talks by Dan Villeneuve, you can see that more than one AOP can be linked together to form a network. And here's a little simple one of estrogen and androgen receptor network, how they might interact. But one of the problems that comes in trying to use AOPs for use beyond adding simple processes and simple straightforward assays is that life is very complicated. As an illustration, this is just a map of the thyroid signaling pathway in humans. There's a lot going on there. And often when we develop AOPs, the key events, we really try to minimize the number of steps and include the most essential ones. And often these steps are in vitro assays that measure processes. And underlying these in vitro methods often are essentially subnetworks representing whole signaling pathways. And when we're trying to apply technologies like omics, which can tell us a lot about what's happening in the tissue, it becomes problematic when you're trying to use in a simple AOP concept. So omics, this is a transcriptional analysis of livers of fish exposed in the environment across cancer pathways and KEG, and the blue are downregulated, red are upregulated. And you can see that a number of genes related, if you could actually see it very closely, there's a number of genes related to cancer apoptosis. There's MYC genes being upregulated, P53 is being upregulated. So we can start understanding potential pathways that might be impacted related to cancer. But one of the things I want to talk about, share with you, is how we're trying to approach bridging the gap between biological networks, where we may have like lots of disease pathways figured out at a very detailed level, to a more regulatory biology in terms of AOPs. So right now we're developing with Lyle Burgoon in our labs a tool called AOP Explorer. And basically what AOP Explorer is supposed to do and designed to do is present simple and complex networks that will bridge AOPs and biological pathways. And how they're doing that is using key event communities. And a key event community is essentially key event components that are inside or part of a key event. As Carol probably told you, there was a number of key events she had in her alkylation leading to cancer network. But within those are often several events that cause that major key event. And what we're doing is we're extracting out the key event components, the little individual parts, making a key event community essentially, or a subnetwork of interacting genes or pathways. We're making it so that you can collapse this pathway down into the key event, major key event, and then expand it back out into the key event community. What this lets you do is have multiple components for key events. And ultimately, what lets you relate AOPs more directly to biological networks. Myself, I like complex things, so I like working on biological networks in lots of detail. But then AOPs are very, very useful for trying to communicate and understand just what am I measuring and how is it really related to something of regulatory concern. So to try to capture the utility of both of those, we're trying to develop this approach of complex networks where sub-networks can collapse into the key events that they actually support. So if you remember from what Carol talked, she talked about the wiki, and there's a number of places there. So key event components are on a key event page where a researcher will describe what a key event is. Here it's cellular homeostasis, apoptosis. There's an event called a table called key event components, and essentially you can list different objects that your event is composed of, whether it's a multiple genes or signaling cascades or what you'd like, then we can compose a network of those. So using that approach, we started to look at how we can look at effects of complex mixtures on fish and use it in a sort of a hypothesis-driven context by marrying transcriptomic results to AOPs. So the example I wanted to talk about was an example of monitoring the effects of chemicals in rivers using caged fat-fed minnows and doing the analysis using transcriptomics and AOPs. So what was done there in collaboration with the EPA Duluth Laboratory, we had fish exposed in cages that were placed at different sites at three wastewater treatment plants. Sites, effluent discharge sites in the Detroit River, and then we had three other sites in the Toledo River, one near an effluent discharge site in the water, two upstream of that were, one was a formerly used oil site, and another's near a creek inlet. So these native fish in this area had been known to have tumors, liver tumors and skin tumors on them. So that area had been noticed to cause these effects on native fish. And so one of the questions we had is, can we detect that in fathead minnow males that were exposed for 4 days in this water and then analyzed by transcriptomics. So we did the exposures and then looked at gene expression in livers of the fish after 4 days of exposure. But what we did is to link it to AOPs because we wanted to see how that observed effect was linked to the outcome of concern. Of course, the outcome of concern that we are interested in here was really liver cancer tumor formation. And there happened to be there's actually two AOPs in the wiki right now that are in development right now. And Carol's actually one of the lead authors of that. This is essentially chronic CYP2E1 activation leading to liver cancer. What we looked at, we modified that slightly and went and we're looking at the hypothesis that sustained AR activation leading to CYP induction, whether it's cytochrome P450 2E1 or cytochrome P450 1A1, more common P450, were active, leading to oxidative stress, hepatotoxicity, hepatoregeneration, proliferation. Angiogenesis is also on here, but it got left out of this figure. Then ultimately a cancer outcome. And then try to do that using what information we can extract out using omics with gene enrichment and fold change analysis. So how did we do this? So what we did is use key event components and subnetworks to relate to the AOP. We started with literature and known pathways of cancer, such as present in PEG and in other pathway databases. We made an AHR activation leading to liver cancer network. Now, of course, this is much more of a biological network. There's a lot more components than just four or five different key events. So it's got all the actual genes, proteins, all the actual proteins, intermediate molecules, and metabolites that might be essential for going from AHR activation leading to potential tumor formation and cancer in liver. And then we made subcomponents out of this network and related those to separate key events within the linear liver cancer AOP so that we could bridge both worlds of complex biology and the relatively simple causal pathway in regulatory biology. To do this, we first developed this detailed AHR cancer network, and we do most of our work in Cytoscape. And as you can see here, this has events within them, such as oxidative DNA damage, spontaneous mutation, gene silencing, expression of specific genes or proteins like AMPK. There's cyclin D1, there's DNA MT3A, which is a DNA methylase, there's peroxide. So there's quite a range of different data that we can enter into this network there if we have it. For our purposes here, we're just seeing what we can do with transcriptomics and gene set enrichments and things like that. So basically, as I said, we fit some subnetworks of genes and pathways to the relevant events in the AOP, basically broken down into the seven events, whether it's AHR activation as an MIE leading to P450 induction, subsequent oxidative stress, and so forth. To do this, we imported transcriptomic gene enrichment, PCR, and inferred values for genes into the network. One of the nice things by using some of the transcriptomics, if you can transfer it over to human gene orthologs, you can use tools available in packages such as individual pathway analysis to get estimates of potential activation of nuclear transcription factors based on the genes that are expressed. So it gives you an idea of if some of these proteins are actually, if they're made, if they were potentially active in the system you're analyzing. So this is fairly simple, just bring it to import as a table in Cytoscape, and then it will actually align it import it as a table, and then it will align it alongside the specific node or protein, however you call it, there, and let you look at values. So what we can now see is that we can examine genes and subnetworks as event components. So here's expanded out what event components would look like for AHR activation MIE. For our purposes here, we just have ARNT and AHR expression. Each column or bar is a either gene expression or a Z-score for enrichment of a protein or gene here. So this is gene expression of AHR, and we can see at each individual site what the expression of that is, and then we can follow it over to expression of either CYP2E1 or CYP1A1 as part of the subnetworks within CYP's induction KE. So we can look at the individual expression of each of the cytochrome P450s. We could also enter other P450s into this if you think they're appropriate, and they fit within the definition of this KE. So across all sites, all P450, CYP1A1 was fairly highly expressed. And then we can do this subsequently for all the other key events, looking at how all the different key events behave within our system. And as you can see, some of these networks, subnetworks, get fairly complicated. This is essentially the network for angiogenesis and the network for hepatoregenerative proliferation expanded out, or subnetworks. And they look like a fairly complex network that actually make these key events work. It would also be nice if we could put in proliferation assays for this, or some actual angiogenesis assays for this. However, this is doing monitoring of effect mixtures in the environment on an animal. We don't really have these assays available, so we're using transcriptomics to approximate this. So with this, we're actually able to see key components like we have expression across all sites and all fish of several oncogenes, including NIC-B, NIC-N, and one site we have expression of NIC-A. These themselves have been shown in transgenic experiments to show that if you have constitutive overexpression of these genes, you can start cancer and tumor formation. So these can be causal events for cancer formation. And then so we can incorporate all these different events and start looking at, well, how is this behaving across my system? The beauty of this is it does let you incorporate other markers into them. If you have Vitellogen and plasma levels, you can incorporate that into estrogen receptor signaling impacts. If you have other assays like foci or cells, histology, data, you can also integrate those into here and start building sort of a weight of evidence across your different sites for how much they're impacting each pathway at different levels. So ultimately, we really are interested in liver cancer in these fish. And one of the nice things, as I said, with an IPA analysis is that they have specific functions with human and rat data that they've mapped to specific gene expression patterns. So they have several patterns of genes that are related to liver cancer and tumorigenesis. And the orthologs of the human genes that are related to tumorigenesis were fairly highly enriched and expressed in many of the different sites where fish were exposed in both rivers. And actually, for carcinogenesis, an enrichment Z-score is highest right here at a site where the same year that wild native fish were captured, and there was a significant increase in tumor formation of fish that they captured at that site relative to all the other sites. So it's actually consistent with wild fish caught in the environment. So basically, this network will really help in taking some traditional, well, some omic approaches, trying to integrate different types of biomarkers and helping develop a weight of evidence for assessing and communicating potential for different outcomes in exposed animals. And the nice part, it really helps marry the benefits of using omics with the benefits of using AOPs. And side by side, what I've got here is sort of a weight of evidence table of an AOP with activation of gene expression or enrichment of different things, or activation of AHR. Green is not is a no, and red is yes. And so basically this summarizes what that whole network says and is a little bit closer to what the actual AOP is. But between using this approaches, we think we can really marry the two approaches together. So my last part of it, I wanted to quickly go over some other approaches we're trying to use to marry data with AOPs. One approach we're trying to do is take high throughput transcriptomics and do AOP-based hazard assessment with the idea that we might be able to identify a hazard threshold or safe exposure limit based on changes in known pathways that are related to adverse outcomes here. So take advantage of specific pathways that are AOPs or known to be related to a regulated outcome of concern. Take differentially do five concentration exposures to animals. This was with human pluripotent stem cells, C. elegans, Daphnia magna, and zebrafish embryos. Then we could identify differential expressed genes with monotonic concentration responses, that is essentially a dose increasing dose response at all the levels. Taking those, and then we can identify specific pathways that they're related to and start forming an AOP, a putative AOP network that potentially would be related to the mechanisms of that. The benefit here is that the genes that we're looking at to try to make points of departure and impacts on, we can scientifically relate to actual outcomes of concern. So right here is steroidogenesis, and these are liver cells, and TNT is actually known to cause, potentially cause steroidogenesis. So this exposure is consistent with what we know about the toxicology. And so we can use the genes near that to try to get, well, what is a dose that causes no change in expression in genes related to that pathway? And then we can use that to derive potential exposure threshold that might be protective. So the benefit of that is that we're trying to use transcriptomics based on known pathways linked to our outcomes of concern. So that can be beneficial in understanding things. I also wanted to communicate to you some of the events that we're trying to develop with OECD, EPA, the European Union's Joint Research Council, on trying to develop quantitative approaches for AOPs. Translation of an AOP into a quantitative computation AOP model really happens in a lot of different ways, and is often a gradient going from a qualitative AOP, which is mostly what we've been talking about here, which just basically describes an AOP, to a quantitative one where we have some type of function relating the concentration at the MIE to the concentration effect at a KE and so forth. A qualitative AOP really ends up being very similar to a conceptual model, so it really operates well to help build quantitative models. And right here is where we just talked about the AEPs, how they fit in right there. So one of the big things you have to be concerned with a QAOP model is that you really have to design it for the question answered. If you're really only interested in screening-level questions, you can do fairly simple ones like Bayesian models and prioritization. But you need much more complex models to quantify impacts on populations. And where you need much higher biological fidelity and lower uncertainty, you definitely need more complicated models. As I said, AOPs can be conceptual models for QAOPs. You really have to incorporate the thrust of the intent of the AOP in there. i.e. the causal events going from the MIE through to an outcome. However, you may not model all the details of the AOP depending on your question, or your question could require that you model more detail within it. So that's such as the case when there's feedback control that controls expression and dynamics within a key event. Also, what's really important in doing AOP models is document them very clearly. There's some recommendations that are going to be put out in the next few months about how to use documentation, such as the TRACE documentation, for documenting how AOPs are made, QAOPs are made and used. Many different types of models can be used depending on the need. There's essentially a formulation cycle that goes into making AOP models that are very similar to doing that for environmental models. Really, problem definition, conceptual model development and consulting methodology, data, getting data and parameterizing the models, and testing for uncertainty. If it's suitable for what you want to use it for, then you can use it, but then you can go back through the cycle and reformulate to get a better model. What we think is kind of unique with the AOP models and what we are trying to encourage people to use it is that because of the AOP knowledge base and the AOP wiki and Effectopedia, that a large source of knowledge is being built up as time goes by and more people contribute, that you can start building models, use information that's useful for modeling on it. And I kind of view the AOPKB as really storing a lot of information that could be useful in defining the biology needed to be modeled and helping us understand what are the gaps in it. So I'm very excited about its potential, especially when it's being crowdsourced. So I wanted to present just a couple quick applications of QAOP models. One, we're developing and looking at the use of binary state Bayesian network QAP model. This is for steatosis. Essentially, we put together 10 or 11 AOPs and linked them to steatosis or fatty liver. And for those who don't know, Bayesian networks are essentially joint distribution of probability models, where you have the probability of this SXR being activated depends on the state of this one. And then when it's at a joint with more than one thing, then it's dependent upon all three. So it lets you start calculating probabilities that one thing can be turned on but another is not. So you can start developing a semi-quantitative or quantitative measure using any kind of assay data you would like. Here's one illustration. If you have inhibition at the HSD 17B4, which is an essential event, you inhibit that. All the upstream receptors become negative. So for this to be down, for this to be turned down, these are off, generally off. The subsequent one downstream, which is dependent upon it, is the accumulation of fatty acid beta oxidation in mitochondria. That goes down. And since fatty acid beta oxidation basically inhibits the formation of fatty livers because it metabolizes the fatty acids, you would cause steatosis because you're no longer inhibiting the steatosis. So based on the biological knowledge and understanding potential probabilities of these events happening, you can start developing a simple quantitative AOP network. We've tried to make that a little bit easier to do by developing a GUI to run Bayesian models called Biscuit. Lyle Begin also has a point of departure tool called Gravy, so you can have your biscuits and gravy and still get something out of it. So Biscuit helps run this, and it runs, tells you what your probability nodes are and what happens after you do it. It's a simple two-click one, upload data, and then run it. This is some of the data we've gotten. Here's steatosis AOP BayesNet with real data taken from a paper by Angrish et al. basically, we were able to look at six different chemicals and give a 99% certainty of a yes or no on each of those. So by using this Bayesian network, we're able to take data as diverse as mitochondrial respiration, fatty acid accumulation, or gene expression, and use that to parameterize whether these nodes are on or off, and then be able to estimate what the potential impact on steatosis, our end point of concern, is. We think this will be really, really nice and for a screening type of approach and integrating in vitro data, maybe even looking at mixture effects. The last model I wanted to present is a large model that took several years. It's actually a multi-component model that took several years to build in collaboration with EPA, with Rory Connellan's group. That's a quantitative model depicting inhibition of aromatase leading to impairment of ovulation and spawning. Basically here, it takes a ODE, complex ODE model with feedback, with a feedback control mechanism in it, linking it to a stochastic Monte Carlo model depicting oocyte development, linking that then to a population dynamics model, which is a Leslie Matrix type of model. But what this lets you do is basically say how much you're inhibiting, how much chemical you have in there. It takes it and it virtually inhibits aromatase and then calculates all the way back, given that aromatase concentration, how much population decline would you expect? So depending on the question you're trying to answer, you can use several different modeling methods. But the AOP framework, I think, is very conducive to developing these types of models at many different scales. So in summary, I hope I've given you kind of a taste of how you can actually use biological networks and integrate them with AOPs. We think it's very useful for a hypothesis-driven analysis of different chemicals and mixture effects. What's also exciting is the ability to bring in biomarkers that you might use, whether the protein, metabolomic, or other types, gene expression, or any other kind of biomarkers, and integrate them into the context of the biological network and the AOPs. We do think transcriptomes can be useful for examining AOPs along if you can integrate the key components and relate those to subnetworks. One interesting concept would be to see how we can quantify impact seen at the subnetwork level and roll that up into an impact on a key event level. I hope I sort of explained to you how descriptive AOPs can form the basis of quantitative AOP models and that QAP models can vary widely in type application, but can be very simple or complex, not complex. So I don't want to scare you away from trying to do it. Overall, I think there's a lot of potential for using data in an AOP context, whether it's using, trying to overlay it on top of networks for assessing how it supports a hypothesis or actually using the data to drive models in an AOP context. And none of this work would have been possible without all of these people. Lyle Dragoon, especially, who did most of the computational support on this and development of this ingredient. Thanks a lot, and I guess that's all I have.
Great. Thank you so much, Ed, for your perspective on AOPs, especially the fact that they can both be used in ecological studies, and I think that the discussion on the QAOPs was really interesting. So now we'll take a few questions from the Q&A pod. So the first one that came in for you was, if you want to combine different AOPs with each other, how do you then handle differences in the KE composition, different components of the KE community? And then this is sort of a follow-up. Maybe KE are the same, but the components not.
The AOPs and KEs are actually living documents, so potentially that may mean that there are missing components from the previous KE. So part of the design of the WICI and EPRS outcome pathways is that the KEs are modular. So while some of the variation could be between species, which would be significant in causing potential differences, I wouldn't expect to be such a variation between within a species. So it could just require an update of a key event.
Okay. The next question that came in was, do you take directionality within pathways into account within your Cytoscape network?
Yes.
Okay.
yes, they are. here, I'll show you, actually. You might be, let me see, right here. So right here, we've got plasminogen or inhibiting cellular matrix stabilization. However, cellular matrix stabilization promotes angiogenesis. So we actually have type of action, inhibition or activation within these interactions. And so you can have multiple ones where oxidative DNA damage, the lack of it, oxidative DNA damage is bad for genetic stability, so it inhibits genetic stability, but it's good for spontaneous mutation. So it can do an event here, sub-event can do multiple actions.
Okay. So I think the next question was more of just a clarification question. Like, for example, when you're looking at that slide right now with carcinogenesis and that it's yellow, that must be linking to the general AOP pathway, correct?
Oh, no, that was just because that just means the node is selected on this network.
Okay, that's what I thought,
In Cytoscape, when you click on it, it turns yellow as the default.
Okay, well, thank you. Okay. So the next question was, your use of gene expression in fish liver to understand cancer creates chaos for interpretation. The liver cancer starts from a single stem cell in the liver. The bulk of the liver has diploid, tetraploid, octoploid, hepatocytes, and other cell types. How can you detect the critical event in that single cell?
If it's a single cell, you may not. I think there's different states that you have to have that single cell to propagate it and have the mutations. But you still have to have a background events to happen. So I agree. Right now we're currently developing it, and that's a that's one of the things of trying to get the key event meeting what's actually really happening in biology. I don't know why we could detect it, but we are often able to, if it's over a certain threshold, the expression, we can detect it in a heterogeneous tissue. We can still detect events that are happening in small amounts of that tissue. But it's something we're trying to explore and understand.
Okay. Well, thank you. So I can tell you we are approaching time. I believe we're supposed to end this at 3:00. So I want to just tell all the speakers once again, thank you so much for doing this. We did receive a number of questions, and I think what will happen is you'll receive the questions, et cetera. So with that being said, I think we do have to close it up. But before we conclude, I wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the very near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also in the related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. And I also want to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. So for more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN website, the EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page. You can follow EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter. Join the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN LinkedIn group. You can also visit the SRP Risk E-Learning webpage, and you can also follow SRP NIEHS on Twitter. Again, I'd like to thank all of our speakers. So now it's approaching 3 p.m. Eastern Time, so we'll have to conclude this webinar. If you did submit an online question and we did not have time to get to it, we will send your questions to the presenters. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. Our email is their email.